Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast, episode 94.
Greetings and welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I am your host, Don Cardenas, and today I am joined by the astounding writer of Beef Bros, The Worst Dudes, No One Left to Fight, and so many other awesome independent books, Aubrey Sitterson. Aubrey, thank you for joining me today.
Don, thank you for having me, man. I'm really stoked to be chit-chatting with you today about some of my favorite things.
I can't be so loud. I heard myself echoing in the background there.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. That's
we'll fix it in post. It's fine.
I'll fix it in post. And if I don't, tough. You can ask for a refund.
If you don't,
later,
then this
everybody.
Is like a, this is like a meta joke. This is us being funny about it. So yeah. We're covered either way.
Yeah, as long as you acknowledge it, you can do whatever you want. It's been a long time coming. I think we obviously share a lot of the same interests. We know a lot of the same people, and apologies in advance if this podcast turns into the Tyrell Cannon love fest.
Oh man, I got a lot to say.
But I've had Tyrell's a bud. I've had him on the show a couple of times, and his work with you on Beef Bros is just absolutely, absolutely killer. But you were super
dude,
awesome person.
You sent me a whole bunch of PDFs that they've posted. You seen the little snippets.
Oh god. And then he's doing that Aliens story of the Inktober, and I'm just
outrageous.
Like, man, Tyrell, his style it's already turned into love fest already. See, everybody, just mentioning his name brings the love.
I'm worried because he's told me stuff, and then there's like stuff that's public, and then there's stuff that's like only in the Kids Love Chains newsletter. Have they said what it's called and like who's doing it? Can we say
publicly? I think they announced it, I believe.
The Schlub with Tyrell. The Schlub. And Kenny Porter and Ryan Stegman. Amazing.
Nice.
I'm stoked. I'm outrageously stoked for it.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Tyrell's style has evolved to such a kinetic powerhouse of just awesomeness.
Dude, just between Beef Bros and Beef Bros Behind Bars, the growth. Like, honestly, on Beef Bros, just like over the course, like in between him doing the sample pages that we used to run to post on the Kickstarter, and then him actually completing the book, the growth was astounding. And and some of that of course is living with the characters and the world and kind of figuring things out as you go on the page. Of course that always happens, but just like the the sheer cartooning prowess of page design and just his character acting beat to beat. And one of the things I love about working with Tyrell is we have a lot of overlap in terms of our interests and the types of stuff, specifically the type of comics that we like. But it's different enough, man, that I write a script. There's some folks I work with that I'll write a script and I can kind of see in my head what they're going to deliver, like what it's going to look like. And with Tyrell, I always think I know, but it's always a little bit different. It's always something that I would have never done, right? And because I've done layouts for people and stuff, like I'm not a totally inept writer, right? So I'll have in my head what I would expect Tyrell to do, knowing what he can do and what I've seen him do in the past. But what he delivers is always something different. It's always something I wasn't really expecting and works in a way that I didn't even anticipate the page work. It's good. What I am describing to you, my friend, is a good collaboration with Tyrell Cannon because he's aces.
It's amazing because seeing his work from like Victus to now, like I can pinpoint where I saw the turn happening. He did this commission for, I think it was a Batman Beyond commission a few years ago.
Okay.
And that's when I saw like a page turn in my head for his style. I'm like, Oh, Tyrell's getting good now. Like he was always good. Like okay.
He cracked the code, man. He cracked the code. It's exciting to see. And I'm glad I've been able to like hang on for dear life as he did it, man.
Well, he busts his ass for sure. But I think we can cap off the Tyrell Cannon love hour. Now.
Is that enough? Okay. All right. We just gotta
let's go.
I just wanted to get out of the way first. I want to make sure we had time for it.
So before we talk about the rest of your works, No One Left to Fight Stone Master and all that. I gotta ask you, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Okay, you want me to go in order or?
Whatever you want to do. Guest prerogative.
So comics, I just, so right now last night I just finished my reread of Prison Pit, Honey Ryan.
Okay.
Yeah, Johnny's a friend, and I have adored him and his work since always. The entire time, my entire career in comics, predating my career in comics. When I was at Marvel, whenever we had 2 pages to fill, and my boss would be like, "Aubrey, what do you think we should do with these 2 pages?" Johnny Ryan strips. So I've been a huge fan of Johnny's forever, and I love his strips. I love his like one panel like humor, gag panels, and that's what they're called, gag panels. I love all that stuff. It cracks me up. It makes, but Prison Pit's something else. And on this reread, I really appreciate it in a different way. I think I have grown and become more sophisticated as a reader, which I think if you're familiar with Prison Pit, that's a hilarious thing to be saying, right? Because it's this outrageously violent, scatological, mean-spirited, raunchy, filth, action and like sci-fi prison story. But reading Johnny's, I don't know, I found it really inspirational this time around, specifically because it was seeing a guy have, you know, it's, I think it's what so many comic book artists and creators, writers want this too. Want, which is just space to tell the story they want to tell, right? Because seeing Johnny have that much space and be able to stretch out and do sequences that, you know, don't last, you know, because Johnny can do a sequence in 3 panels and just slay, just absolutely destroy. But to see him have 6 pages just to do like what amounts to a single beat, and myself as a reader to really slow down and take the time to appreciate that and think about it. Also seeing just kind of like, I don't know, man. Like there were a couple times when I was just like, oh shit, that is, that's Miura. That's a fucking berserk thing that he just did right there. So like it's true of Tyrell too. It's one of the reasons I like working with him so much is I call it genre archaeology, right? Like I like seeing where people pull things from, and I like seeing how genres and mediums develop. I like seeing the seams, man. Like, and a lot of people, I think some people are afraid of that because they're worried that the work will seem derivative. But I think the utilization of tropes and techniques isn't what makes something derivative. What makes it derivative is the way in which those tropes and techniques are applied, right?
Yeah.
Which sounds like a pedantic distinction, but I think it's an important one.
Well, and, influence versus, you know,
imitation.
It's
exactly. It's the difference between imitating something or seeing that something works and then digging down deep, figuring out what works about it, what you can use from it, and you can assimilate it into what you're creating, right? And that's a much more complicated process than just, oh, I like X and doing your version of that. So I don't know. I think Prison Pit is a pretty remarkable piece of work. I'll say it. I think it's great, man. I finished that last night. And then another thing I'm reading for the first time right now, man, I feel awful about it. Years and years ago at a Stockton comic book convention, Nick Dragotta gave me a stack of East of West comics. And they have been sitting in my stack of comics to read for ages, as they do. And honestly, I was just kind of intimidated because I don't even have all of them. I think I have like 6 of them, like the first 6. And it was just kind of intimidating. And I started the first one last month, and I read the first issue and I realized, oh shit, I gotta slow down. Because there's only so much of this stuff, and it's aces. It's so good. I'm over the moon for it. It's great. It's probably my favorite. It's my favorite Hickman stuff of anything of his that I've read. And Dragotta's work in it is really incredible. He was telling me that he did it. They did it plot script style, like old Marvel style, which makes me even more impressed with him. Right. Because like,
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's neat. And it's like, just like his facility with expressions specifically is what's kind of floored me in that, because a lot of Nick's work, and Nick's really such a talented guy, and he can work in these different styles. What he's doing on East of West, the characters or the facial expressions, they're characters, right? Are tremendous, and they say so very much. And the fact that, and like that coupled with him working kind of plot script style and knowing the weight that, I think it's a credit to him and Hickman both, right? That like both of them recognize the weight and the meaning contained within these atomic strength close-up yeah. panels is really remarkable. The colors are gorgeous too. I emailed Nick just raving about it after I finished the first volume, and I'm in the middle of the second volume now. That's why I'm breaking it up. And I was raving about the colors. What's up?
Yeah, I have to pick that series back up as well. I started picking it up when it first came out. I have a few of the first issues, and I'm not sure why I dropped off. It wasn't a lack of enjoying it. That's for sure.
I have a lot of series like that, man. It's a time and endurance, and it's like, you know, like here's the thing, like East to West is what I want to be reading right this second, but I couldn't guarantee to you that I would want to be reading it once a month over the course of 6 years, you know, like I couldn't say that necessarily. Right. Yeah. It's an interesting, weird thing about comics. And
well, it is, you know, I have, behind me on my shelf, I have all the Ultimate Collections of Invincible.
Oh, cool.
I have the last two, which I have not read yet. I've had those in my possession for over a year now. And it is not because I don't have time to sit down and read it, because I can make the time to sit down and read those. I can't say goodbye yet. it's still there for me to finish. It's just one of those things where, and also I'm sure it's the thing where you're making comics and you don't really have the time to go read comics because you're busy making these things and spending all your energy doing that.
You know, a few years ago, several years ago now, I'm getting old, man. Time waits for no man. It's coming for us. The Grim Reaper, he's looming. A few years back, I made a conscious decision. Because, you know, I've worked in comics, like day job working in comics at Marvel, and then writing comics and editing comics freelance and writing more comics. And I realized that I had, for so very long, just comics had consumed everything, and I had, like comics was most of what I'd read, and I realized that that was probably not great. And so I started making a concerted effort to read more prose. And the thing about reading prose is it takes a lot longer than reading comics. And so, you know, like you can really plow through a ton of comics if you really want to. And that's the thing I mentioned about slowing down with regard to Prison Pit, because especially when I was working at Marvel, you know, because it was a job and we needed to be able to go through lettering fast. You need to be able to read comics and assess whether all the people involved with them were any good or not fast. Cause we got all the Marvel comics. You could find the DC comics around the office. And then there was like indie stuff that I was buying too. And I got in the habit of reading really, really, really quickly, just as quickly as I could, instead of, and that's bad in prose, and I've corrected it there as well, but it's especially bad in comics because, you know, one of the beautiful things about comics is that moments can take as long as you want them to take. They can take what moments exist and the space they take up on the page is up to the artist. And then the reader gets to decide how much time they spend on each one, which of course is informed by the choices the artists make. If you're just rushing through it just to get done with it, you're missing it. You're missing the point. You're missing the page layout, right? You're really just scanning for data. And I think, you know, guided view digital comics have certainly played a part in that tendency as well, right? As opposed to really fully engaging and embracing with this stuff. So what was my point here, Don?
I was just hearing what you're saying. That's all.
Oh no, I found it. Don't worry. My point is it's hard. It's hard to find the time to read everything you want to read. I try and have a balanced diet. You know, I try and read nonfiction, and I read magazines, and I read fiction, and I read comics, and it's just, there's only so many hours, man.
I have to say, you know, doing the podcast, and I've said this very many times on the podcast, so sorry for everyone's had to hear me say this 1,000 times.
Say it again.
But since I tried to recommend comics on the podcast, in the segments before the interviews, that's the only way I can really guarantee I'm reading stuff. And most of the time it's independent stuff at this point. It's usually stuff people are sending me or things my friends are working on. And, you know, it could be easy to say, it's like, oh, I'm just talking about my friend's stuff, but I have really talented friends and they make killer comics. So sorry. Like
it's a nice thing, man. And I mean, I think that there are definitely problems with the fact that a lot of times comics feels like an industry selling things to each other.
Right? Well, yeah, it's, like, it's the same.
There's definitely some issues there. And I think it's true of a lot of like, you know, kind of like more niche fandoms. Mm-hmm. Like there's definitely a problem there. But it's also a very cool thing about comics, I think, man. Like this month is kind of an off month for me in terms of comics I'm reading, because normally I'm grinding through, like you said, like stuff people like my pals things or Kickstarter books. Like, I'm very stoked about his campaign's ending soon. The new Jake Smith Blood Force Trauma, like I read those, like I caught back up on those a couple months ago. Yeah, man, like it's great. It is a cool time to be a comics fan, honestly. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Yeah,
Everybody.
Yeah. I've seen variations of like, you know, Kickstarter is the same $20 being passed back and forth between everybody.
Like that is the joke, you know, it's also a cool thing. It's like that's the definition of a supportive creative community. You know what I'm saying? Like whenever people talk about, and like there aren't really so many anymore because of, I don't need to get into that. But when people talk about like more old fashioned, like localized creative communities, who do you think was supporting each other? They were buying each other's work for nothing and sharing the same money and passing it around. And like, it's a bad thing economically and financially, to be sure. But creatively, it's a great thing. It's a really good thing for contemporary creators to be passing their shit around and supporting each other and learning from one another.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's a tide coming at some point to where it's either going to like become more insular and more closely, you know, reciprocal groups, or things are going to open up a bit more. It kind of felt like it was happening, and then the pandemic hit, and then there's like this weird Kickstarter boom because everyone's like, well, I'm going to do my comic now because, you know, pencils down for a lot of people, whatever. And then, you know, seeing it from my perspective, you know, there was a Kickstarter boom with all these independent things. And then there's like a pretty heavy dip, I think. And then we've had a couple ups, but it feels like there's some sort of momentum building within the independent side of the industry. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, a lot of publishers who have bad practices, not, you know, being called out for those practices. And a lot of publishers smaller publishers who are taking care of people and having good practices are getting more notoriety, getting bigger names to be joining in to help spread the word of all that. So, you know, while there will never be another Image again, you know, not that I don't think there should be, because that was a whole, you know, bridge for the whole House of Cards that was set up to have the industry decline the way it did in the late 90s. I just personally, from my own perspective, I feel like there's some sort of swell coming.
I think there should be a dozen more Images, man. I think Images.
Well,
that
would make more sense.
I don't know if you were doing this or not, but I know I see people do this sometimes. They engage in like Image slander of like what. I don't think I'm not accusing you of doing this, but I mean, the fact of the matter is Image is a uniquely wonderful thing. And this, I don't have a book at Image, so like, I'm not a shill, right? Image is a uniquely wonderful thing, not just in publishing, but in all of entertainment. Nothing else like it exists. It's not set up to make money. It's not, right? It's set up to cover its costs. It's run by a partnership that, again, is not set up to make a profit, right? Like, say what you will about any of those guys and other things they've done, but Image does not make a profit. Image is not earning any of those guys any money. There are no shareholders that they have to appease and pay out dividends to. And that's why they can give folks the best deal anywhere. Nowhere else gives you anything like that, because everywhere else is set up to make a profit.
And
that's my Image commercial. A publisher I don't work for.
Even within Image, there's, you know, the sectors, the Shadow Line, there's Skybound and all that. And
well, the imprints, you know, are different. The rules
are different. But I will say this.
Yeah.
I will say this, because I've seen some criticism of people of Skybound because they take part of the ownership and all that. But they also pay page rates. and you have part, you keep some of the ownership.
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with work for hire as long as everybody is clear on the deal and it's not,
and you still have partial ownership involved with it. Some people don't like the deal, some people do. And I look at someone like Daniel Warren Johnson, who went and did a couple Skybound books and they were very successful. And now Dual Power Bomb is just him at Image. It's not Skybound. It's all him. And it's doing phenomenally.
He's probably making three times as much money as he ever did at Skybound.
Yeah. It's just those building blocks that, you know, he was able to use with the Skybound method. But that's also like one of the awesome and also frustrating things about comics is there's no one way to do things. There's a million ways to do things. And it's just, you know, sometimes what you're doing works, sometimes it doesn't. And it's not, each way is not right for the right person. But if there were more like Images, when I mentioned like the Image thing was not the best thing, I was mainly referencing the speculator aspect of all the releases and all that kind of stuff.
I won't.
But that's.
I feel like Tyrell is smiling now because of all this just vigorous 90s Image defense I'm issuing for.
Oh, it was my jam. Don't get me wrong.
I think folks lay that at the feet of Image. And of course they participated in that. But to act like that wasn't a thing driven by Marvel and DC, I think is disingenuous.
1,000%. They were the worst offenders of it.
Yeah. And they were bigger. They were the bigger players in the market and they were there before doing it. So. Yeah, I don't know. We don't need to relitigate.
That could be a whole. There have been.
You can have me back. My second appearance
series of podcasts or whatever about people exploring that whole thing. Let's talk about good stuff. Let's talk about fun stuff. So you talk about
the next one. I did comics already. What's the next one?
Coffee. How are you on coffee, sir?
So I don't know as much about coffee as you do, I'm sure, because I know very little. I can tell you broadly what I
just tell me,
like, and what I don't like.
This isn't a quiz. Just tell me what you like, how you like it.
When I moved out, I didn't start drinking coffee until I was in my mid to late 20s, same. I don't think.
Same.
And what I liked was rich, nutty coffee. I was living in New York, right? And that was most of what you found places, like really rich, nutty stuff. And not so much chocolatey, but like nutty, right? Like earthy kind of tasting stuff. And I moved out to Los Angeles in 2012 and everywhere, like all of like the cool coffee shops and like increasingly any fucking where you go, they have this like citrusy floral coffee.
Yeah.
And I hate it. I think it's awful. And I think, and you probably know, and so I would love it if you could, let me give you my understanding. You can tell me if this is correct or not. The citrusy, like floral stuff, that's more often than not those are African beans. Whereas like the more nutty, earthy stuff is like America's beans, like South American beans.
In my experience, from what I can recall offhand, I don't pretend to be a coffee expert. I just really love it. I like trying all kinds of coffees. But seeing where things are sourced, that tends to be the case. I am not a fan of like the citrusy, floral kind of coffees. Either. My wife is. I am more of the nuttier. I like a chocolater. I also like a darker roast if it's chocolater, more of a chocolate type of thing. But I think there's maybe one or two like citrusy blends that I've had that were like, okay, this is good. I'm not going to drink it every day, but if I had to drink this, I'd be fine. But yeah, for the most part, I think I'm right in there with you. Like a really good nutty medium roast is like,
That's what I want.
It's like, okay, I can do this all day. Like I can drink this all day, you know? Which I do.
Yeah. I like shitty coffee, man. And that's like, that's the thing. I like shitty diner coffee. And that stuff is usually kind of what you're describing. It's just kind of like a nutty medium roast. And there's nothing really fancy about it. That's what I prefer.
Okay. Do you take it black or you do cream and sugar or just depends on the day?
I go back and forth, honestly. If it's, sometimes it depends on how good the coffee is. Like I think that's usually the deciding factor. If it's really good coffee and that kind of like nutty flavor that I like, then I'll drink it black. Otherwise I might need to put a little creamer in it.
I'm usually like a cream and like one sugar type of guy, though it depends on the roast too. When I get a chance to try roasts and talk about them for the show, I always try them several different ways. I try it black. I try it with my French press. I try it with the drip coffee, just so I can get an idea of it before I talk about it to anybody. But
you know what I used to do when I was I went through a period where I was cutting weight really aggressively, and I was my macros really relentlessly, and I just didn't want to waste any. Because I was really and it's not terribly interesting. I was really watching this stuff, and so I was like, you know what? I don't want to be fucking around with this creamer. It's just empty calories. I don't need this. But sometimes I would want a little extra something in the calorie in my coffee, and I started putting like a teaspoon of cocoa powder in my hot coffee and mixing it up. And it's just like, it's not a mocha, right? But it's just like, it's a calorie free way to make your coffee richer.
Mm-hmm. That's
the life hack from your pal Aubrey. put a little cocoa powder in here. Then I learned. So are you ready for more coffee life hacks, Don?
Let's go.
This is a thing you're allowed to do. You're an adult in these United States of America, which still the land of the free for now, at least. Who knows? Can't speak for the future. But a thing you're allowed to do, you can go to the grocery store, and instead of creamer or milk or any of that, you can get Don turned off his camera. He's so excited. I did not turn off my camera.
Can you hear me okay?
Your camera's not, I can hear you. Your camera's not available. That's how excited you are. You can get a can of Ready Whip, and you can put that right on your coffee. You can put whipped cream on your coffee. And you're an adult. Who's going to stop you? That's a thing I like to do for a treat. I like to get a can of Ready Whip and put it on my coffee instead of creamer.
I was wondering if you're going to bring up the bulletproof coffee that people have been doing.
I don't know what that is. Oh, is that like the life hack coffee?
You put like butter in it, like, or something.
It's got like snake. It's got like a teaspoon of snake oil in there for you.
Yeah, a big old teaspoon of snake oil.
Fuck that. I don't buy any of that. It's nonsense. It's utter nonsense.
Yeah, it's But I just kind of keep, you know, I don't have a lot of vices in my life. You know, food is my big vice. So when I have to cut back
all of them just a little bit.
Yeah.
I like just a little bit of each vice.
So when I have to cut back like the rest of the food stuff, I'm like, I'm still keeping my little bit of sugar and creamer in my coffee. To hell with everything else. That's my small my small victory. Because you know, for the longest time I was a soda guy. Like I would just drink, you know, I still love soda. Like I you know, and especially diet sodas, just because that's what I grew up on, because that's what my family had. Like my favorite soda, I think, is of all time is like, was it caffeine free diet Pepsi? Cause my grandma had that, and that's, I would always steal from my grandma, and it I just like the taste of it. I have no aspersions. That's probably worse for me than regular soda, to be honest, because of all the artificial sweeteners and stuff like that do shit.
I've got opinions on that too, but don't worry.
But regardless, like all things, moderation. But you know, soda is one of the things like I can't really do moderation on. I can start it for a while, but then before I know it, I'm like 5-6 sodas a day deep, and I'm
that's a lot of sodas.
And especially you know, at 40, I'm just walking around feeling super bloated. I'm like, I gotta not have this much soda right now. So
can I tell you about a diet soda I really enjoy?
Sure.
Without like upsetting you, like, is that
no? I am not triggered by diet sodas. I love diets.
That's the thing. I don't want to send you off on a bender by telling you.
I'm a big boy. Okay, I can handle it,
dude. I don't know if they have it. I don't know. Like sometimes there's like regional sodas and stuff too, especially in like Los Angeles, because it's a different market, right? It's a different demographic. Can you get Mountain Dew Baja Blast Zero by you? They make zero sugar Baja Blast. It's life changing. It's an amazing thing for soda boys like ourselves.
I've seen the Baja Blast. Like the last time I had Mountain Dew was when like Code Red was the big one, like in the early 2000s.
That's still my favorite, because that reminds me. I grew up in the South, and we had we had Sun Drop, which was like, you know, Mellow Yellow.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, exactly.
As Mellow Yellow is to Mountain Dew, Sun Drop is to Mellow Yellow. Like Sun Drop is like even like sugarier and like more Southern somehow. And they had, as a kid, they had Cherry Sun Drop, and that's exactly what Mountain Dew Code Red. That's like my like warm inside memory soda, cherry sun drop.
No, I get, you know, the local regional soda thing. We have RC Cola, which is,
I know RC, Royal Crown, baby.
Yeah. It is the absolute like most dog shit soda ever. In my opinion, it tastes like an ashtray, but it only tastes good when it comes in a 1 liter bottle from the pizza place you order from in Chicago.
That's funny.
That's the only time I've ever remembered enjoying it is when it comes in the 1 liter bottle with our stadium sized pizza from Golden Crust in Chicago. And, but for me, like I will forever be chasing the high of the black cherry soda from Aldi's when I was a young man.
Oh, weird.
Cause Aldi's.
So it tasted like a Dr. Pepper.
No, I despise Dr. Pepper.
Oh really? Cause some people do like, a lot of people say black cherry. It's like, it tastes kind of similar to Dr. Pepper.
I don't see the connection. I've softened my views on Dr. Pepper because I would go on a tirade about Dr. Pepper, mainly because I'm a big root beer fan too. And more often than not, especially when I was younger, if we went to a restaurant or somewhere, I'm like, oh, do you have root beer? Like, no, we have Dr. Pepper. That's not fucking root beer. That's Dr. Pepper. Like, I didn't ask you if you have Dr. Pepper. I asked if you had root beer.
It's got caffeine in it. It's
not the same. It's not the same. But no, just in the olden days, if you went to Aldi, it was less a Whole Foods light type place than it is now. And you could just buy single cans of soda, make your own 24 pack. Like you could just buy just random single item things. And they had like the best black cherry soda. I'm not misremembering this because I talked to my wife about this and I've been with my wife for almost, you know, 23, 24 years now. And
long enough for her to just agree with you to get you
long enough to where like, why did we not talk about this soda before? Yes, that's exactly. And this was like a couple of years ago too. It's just like, how do we not know about each other? We both love this soda. So I'm forever chasing that. There's some good ones. There's some good local sodas. There's a Sprecher. They come in, it's a cherry cola that comes in a bottle that, it's, more expensive than it needs to be, but, it's nice to, I buy that as my special treat on the weekends. You know,
you ever had a Cellray?
Cellray? No, I can't say I have.
It's like an old New York soda, okay. And it's celery flavored and it is delicious. It's really, really good. It's like an old, like, you know, like if you were somewhere and you were getting like an egg cream or something, okay. Like you could also get like, you could get a Cellray for yourself. I remember I was really so, cause so like, I haven't had one since I left New York cause you don't find them out. And you know what? That's not true. If you go to certain Jewish delis in LA, you'll have them. Because it's like a Jewish deli soda is what it is. And I was very stoked because did you ever watch Boardwalk Empire?
Oh, we have not. No.
Okay. It's good. It's neither here nor there. But there's some old New York Jewish gangsters on that. Arnold Rothstein and Myers Lansky. And I forget which one of them, but one of them was sipping on a Cellray in an episode. And I cheered. I stood up and cheered for it. I was so excited.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, it's, you know, I think soda's great. And even though it's my weak spot for bad food habits, I will say though, when I am trying to cut back, we haven't had it here in our area for a long time now, for a few months, but Topo Chico lime, that oh, sure. is like, if you like, I was one of those people who like seltzer, like it's just tastes like carbonated nothing, you know. I've grown to like some of them now. But yeah, Topo Chico, it's a mineral water. Technically, I don't know what the difference is between mineral water and seltzer water. Like they're both,
you can charge a little bit more for it.
Yeah, exactly. They put it in a glass bottle and you get to charge an extra 40% for it. But Topo Chico, I know, is very popular, but their twist of lime variant is just like, I could easily use that to replace any soda cravings I have. And also goes really great with when I use it to marinate skirt steak. But anyway, I recommend if someone sees that out there, some Topo Chico with twist of lime, definitely get that. It's a great fizzy lime, you know, it hits all the, I think all the brain dopamine centers that you would get with soda, I think, minus the sugar. So, hey. Anyway. See, you know, we started talking, now we're talking about soda for 20 minutes.
There you go.
So let's get to it. Let's get to the metal. Let's get to the metal. I know
metal. Yeah.
I know you're a fan of plenty of metal.
I am.
And like coffee, this isn't a quiz. I just want to know what you're enjoying, what bands you've been listening to lately, new, old, whatever.
New wise, I've really enjoyed the latest Sumerlands album.
Okay.
Do you know them?
I've heard of them. I've seen their albums pop up from time to time. I haven't jumped into them yet.
It's good, man. They've got like overlap with Eternal Champion, which is another favorite.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm familiar with them. Yeah.
Like Eternal Champion, they are kind of a it's a thing that's really common in metal these days. I mean, to my understanding, right? Because I think you know more about metal than me. I'm like being careful. I don't want to like overstep bounds. But a thing that appears to me to be really common in metal is kind of this. It's like a process of rehabilitation and also reappreciation of older kind of subgenres and like picking them up and like dusting them off and then creating kind of like a romanticized version of this thing that oftentimes I think for contemporary audiences ends up working a little bit better than that original version did. So like Eternal Champion is very much that for power metal, right?
Yeah.
Which I'm not really a power metal guy. It doesn't really like my home base is very much like slow, like doomy, sludgy stuff, you know.
Sleep.
And like truthfully, like yeah man, and like I'm wearing a Conan shirt right now, like that kind of stuff, you know. And like I've learned more, like, you know, my wheelhouse is kind of like like even more so, and I like Sabbath, but even more so than Sabbath, it's Deep Purple, man. It's Deep Purple and it's like Cirith Ungol and it's like groovy, it's groovy metal that still has kind of like this psychedelic edge to it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not a huge power metal guy, but Eternal Champion, it's like a idealized version of what I would want power metal to be, right? Eternal Champion, when I listen to it, is what I want. I like Manowar, but like I don't very often sit down and just get real deep into a Manowar album. Like that's just not really a thing I do. Like I like it when I hear it, but like, it's a different thing. And Sumerlands similarly is that for, I get ready to pick up all these names I'm about to drop. The late great Riley Gale was a really, really dear friend of mine. Riley Gale was the lead vocalist of Power Trip. And one time when he was out here with Power Trip in LA, I was going to go meet him for lunch. He says, I'm going to bring my friend with me. You're going to love him. His name is Arthur Risk. And Arthur, at the time, he produced albums for Power Trip. He produced Code Orange albums. He was on his way to becoming this metal super producer who also his guitars and drums and like just whatever else needs done for like a bunch of different bands, including Eternal Champion. And he was like, oh, you're going to love my new, this other band. It's Sumerlands. And Riley was like, oh, tell him about Sumerlands. And I was like, yeah, man, lay it on me. Cause he's wearing a Cirith Ungol shirt too.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, hell yeah. And he told me, he was describing Sumerlands to me and I was really polite because he was Riley's friend and he was like a really nice guy and I just met him, but he was like, yeah, it's like our take on, you know, 80s Sunset Strip Ozzy.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, that stuff doesn't really click for me. Like it's just not my favorite thing. Like, but goddamn, if Sumerlands doesn't do the exact same thing that Eternal Champion does in terms of like capturing what like the idealized in my head kind of like simplified like character version of that, it's something that, you know, dozens of different influences that I don't know enough about to like really pinpoint.
Yeah.
but they make it feel contemporary and modern in a way that still has that throwback element. I think the latest Sumerlands album, Sumerlands, is just outrageous. It's
okay.
Incredible.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. It's really cool. Metal, I absolutely adore it. It's not the only thing I listen to. I listen to plenty of other things. But it is the main thing I listen to. It is the thing I love to make. It is the thing that I feel is the best like, just like I feel like comics is the best medium to tell stories in. I feel like metal is the best music, best medium to make music in. And mainly because you can do things like you're talking about, taking something older and kind of like still being able to make it feel fresh and new and modern and reinvented, even though it's something that's heavily influenced by stuff that was popular 30, 40 years ago. And
what's the genre archaeology thing that I was talking about earlier, right? Yeah. It's this idea of like, of wearing your influences on your sleeve and kind of flexing in terms of like, well, look, I understand, not only do I know of all these things, but I understand how they work and I can dissemble them and put them together into something brand new, you know? And I love metal too, man. And for me, it is all of the endless subgenres that you can really, that you, like the thing I said to you earlier is absolutely insane. Like the fact that like, I'm like, my wheelhouse is more like Deep Purple influenced and like pre new wave of British heavy metal, American blues and psychedelia influenced metal. So like where that lives. And like you as a guy who knows metal, that doesn't sound insane to you. But I'm sure you recognize that is nuts. That's like, it's an absolutely bonkers thing for a human being to say to somebody else.
It's, you know, I've taken to reviewing albums on my YouTube channel and talking about music a lot for the podcast. And I just, you know, I try to respect what bands say their genre is, but when I'm talking about it, but it really is all just marketing. Like you just, that's all that's driven behind the genre, even for something as niche as a lot of these metal things are, because, you know, growing up, you know, being a teenager in the late 90s, you had thrash metal, you had, you know, the groove metal, you had like industrial metal, new metal, and like death and black metal. And now you have like, you have death metal, you have blackened death metal, you have Norwegian death metal, you have Florida death metal.
You have black and roll. You have death and roll.
Death and roll.
Right.
You have, you know, you had hardcore, then you had metalcore, then you have deathcore, then you have...
You also have grindcore.
Grindcore. And then you have, please. You know...
power violence, of course.
Black, you know, I've seen the term black metalcore and all these other things. And it's just like, metal has gotten to the point to where, which I love, I absolutely love, is that bands can be so many crazy ass different things. I just reviewed the latest Lorna Shore album and they are a huge, you know, I guess metal/deathcore type band. And the stuff they do on their album is like, they have the super mega low tuned guitar breakdowns that are just, you know, hammering that open string chug, you know, rhythmic stuff. But then they have passages where, you know, they're fucking doing sweep solos and there's some of these riffs that are just like, you're going to break your fingers, you know, just trying to like figure them out and all that. It's just such a, so many influences being pulled into this thing, but it all works, you know?
Yeah.
And one thing that kind of got me is, there was this, I forget the name. Why am I forgetting the name? But a band just put out a cover of Blinding Lights by The Weeknd, and they're kind of like a folk metal band. I forget their name of it. But I'm like, I just remember back in the early 2000s where Children of Bodom did a Britney Spears cover, and they caught so much shit for doing that. And now it's like expected if there's a huge pop song, like how many metal bands are going to fall over themselves to cover this song, and people are going to eat it. There's a metal Blinding Lights cover on my workout playlist. Like I'm not poo-pooing the method. It's just kind of funny where I feel like metal can take anything, any music, any song, and make it metal, make it its own thing. And pop and all the other genres, they can't do that. You know, they can bring those influences here and there, but like more often than not, you end up with like a Kelly Clarkson song that sounds like because they stole the riff from a Yeah 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 song. It doesn't work. It doesn't work backwards to me. And that's why I feel like metal is like this.
One of the things I really appreciate about metal is it's bands.
Yeah.
It's a band. It's live musicians. You know, it is people making music to be played live that they're going to be expected to play live. And it doesn't end up overproduced, but it also has, you know, there's multiple cooks in the kitchen for any kind of metal song you're listening to, but there's not so many that their contributions aren't still distinct, right? It's not, and like, I don't know. I don't want to get into like a thing about like, oh, you know, once a song has X amount of writers, it's no longer art. No, that's tiresome. That's not what I'm doing. Who cares?
But like, I don't look at who's writing what songs. Like,
But one of the things I like about metal in general is that, it's bands. It is everything that comes with that. In that, you know, like there is this push and pull, and there are these different influences even within singular songs. And it's rock music, man. That's the other thing that I think like kind of gets lost some when people who aren't, even people who are into metal, kind of lose sight of sometimes. Man, it's rock and roll. It's rock music. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's a subgenre of rock, of the broader rock and roll category. But like, I don't know, you have to get into some pretty deep, specific black metal stuff before I'm willing to grant that it's not rock and roll anymore, right?
Just
like,
there's just noise, yeah.
And people lament all the time, like the state of rock and roll music, and there's no innovation being done in rock and roll, and there's, you know, like the only like real new innovative music is in hip hop or pop music or whatever. And I think those people are not listening to metal music because there's so much weird, fascinating, smart, specific stuff being done in metal. And the fact that we can have these like very specific, like I don't know, like every week I read I go to metalinjection.com and I read the new albums out, and I read all these just deranged specific descriptions, and I can tell whether it's something that I might be interested in, right? Just because I know enough about like the weird Venn diagram of my interests to be able to determine that. And that's a treat, man. And metal's not all I listen to either. In fact, yeah, like, I don't know. Today I was listening to all non-White Stripes Jack White bands. Just all Raconteurs and Dead Weather. Just because that's what I wanted to be listening to. And that's fine. But like, yeah, man, metal is kind of a home base for me because it is just one of these other I think, you know, it's something you can dig into. It is something you can do this genre archaeology with. And you can discover like, oh, wow, this thing that this band was doing, they didn't invent that. That came from this band. So now I can go listen to their catalog too. And they were also pulling from these bands. And then you end up back at Blue Cheer or whatever. Just a day spent listening to Blue Cheer.
And one of the things I do, you know, to keep adding things we love about metal, but like you said, it's very much a band, as you know, people just coming together, bashing their stuff together. And there's stuff like that I love, where it's just, you know, 3, 4, 5 guys or ladies, like just going hard on their instruments, you know, and the way it's recorded, like they're barely holding on to any type of semblance of like a consistent time signature or BPM or whatever. Like, and then there's stuff I listen to that's incredibly produced. There was a recent semi-controversy about this band Falling in Reverse, who they use a lot of additional layers and sounds and things like that in their show. So they have it on their laptops or whatever that they play while they're playing. A lot of like sound production type stuff, like, you know, orchestra stuff and stuff like that. And they lost their laptops, so they had to cancel the show. And then like the Eddie Trunk, threw some shade at him because he was at Aerosmith. He's like, oh, this is real rock music, no laptops, blah, blah, blah. Even though I'm 1000% sure Aerosmith's backline has a few fucking laptops playing some shit.
I'm 100% sure that Steven Tyler is powered by a laptop at this point.
And then, of course, Sebastian Bach chimes in.
Directing him.
Yeah, Sebastian Bach chimes in, and the singer from Falling in Reverse, they get into this whole ridiculous thing. And it's not really worth researching other, it's just, you know, old men yelling about technology and, you know, a guy trying to defend the fact that his band, you know, uses a lot of technology in their band, you know, and there's a lot of things that bands use that technology for, like switching between effects and things like that without having to do it on stage, so they can run around and be more free on stage. They can have it timed to like, okay, now my guitar, you know, amp simulator that we use, because no one really uses real amps and tours anymore, not even Metallica. It's like, it's all pre-programmed, but it's all in the service of like providing a tight, consistent show or whatever. But there's music like that, like the Lorna Shore album I mentioned. There's huge soundscape type things, just background echoes and sounds and things and happening that are incredibly immersive and epic and huge. But then there's you know, again, four people just like making a whole lot of noise in a room, and it's all great. It's all awesome.
Don, can I tell you something that I just find, it's not really related to metal, but it's something that just occurred to me. I agree with you, right? Like, I don't know Falling in Reverse, and I don't know about that controversy, but I believe it happened. I trust you.
Yeah, you can just.
I'll look it up later. I'll do my own desktop research.
It's really just old man yells at cloud, and you know.
Yeah, 100%. But like, while you're telling me about this, about, you know, like all these crusty old metal guys yelling about a band that dares to use computers, laptops to make music as part of their live shows, there are, I don't know how many people having meltdowns about AI art right now as we speak. Yeah. How is that different? Describe to me how different that's different.
Because
describe to me, please.
Because the music they make the music that is then being replayed, and they compose that. They do not.
Oh, I see.
Type in a bunch of
words.
They don't use like a garage band type thing to make the music, whatever. You know, you can program stuff and all that.
But that's not music they made then, right?
It is. It's all, you know, they program the notes. They put the notes in. They play it. AI art is basically, you know, taking from existing art that was made and mashing it together, and frankly, just more often than not, whatever I see, just really shitty ways. Especially the, why am I spacing on his name? The legendary artist who passed away recently, Kim. I'm totally blowing it here. Future Don here, just popping in to say the artist I was referring to was the legendary Kim Jung-gi, who sadly passed away far too young. He was a master at drawing without construction lines and was just effortless, it seemed, with his ability and talent. And someone that was that staggeringly good gone so soon is truly, truly a loss for the entire art world, much less illustration. And yeah, just want to make sure I give props there. And then also make sure there's going to be some links to some of his videos in the show notes, so you can see him at his prime when he was working and just doing this amazing, amazing stuff.
I know what you're talking about. And that was definitely gross. And like, I think there's separate issues here, right? Like there's an issue of stealing people's art and then repurposing it and using it and claiming it as your own,
yeah,
which is obviously,
yeah,
no bueno, right? Yeah.
I agree.
And I think that's the point I was trying to get to is that like, I see a lot of freaking out just about the sheer existence of this stuff. Right.
Yeah.
But to my mind, it's, you know, worrying about AI art taking over for actual human being artists is kind of we've had the capability to type in text and have a voice say it, mm-hmm, for decades now. And we still have voice actors. And there's a reason for that, right? Because actual human beings and artists are still capable of nuances of expression and metaphor and exploration of themes that AI is just not capable of and isn't going to be capable of in any time in the near future. So yeah, like I think it's interesting, man, how that stuff gets conflated. Because for sure, stealing somebody's art and feeding it into a computer program to then make, like, I'm doing air quotes if you're listening to the audio version, to make new art, obviously that's theft, right? And it's tricky, right? Because of what is transformative art, right? And this is, mm-hmm, an argument people have had like for decades again. But I think that's like a real, being upset about that is a real different thing than being upset about just like the principle or the very existence of stuff. And I see a lot of the latter. I see quite a bit about the latter.
I'm not shouting at the rooftops every single day, but you know, I have made my opinion known that I think mainly the people who are using AI art specifically in that manner, where they are literally typing in an artist's name for it to pull the info from, it's fucking lazy and disgusting. And then they go and they want to claim it as their own, as a tool. And if people want, you know, if there is a, you know, I know there's people who, I may be slightly incorrect on this, but that willingly said, here's, you can use my stuff as source material to pull from or whatever. You know, I've seen people like kind of sign off on a few of those things, but there's people who haven't. And the idea, I think what's pisses people off so much right now is because, you know, as you're fully aware of, you know, the idea of art being diminished, like the value of an artist alone being diminished is being, it feels like it's just being ramped up even faster, when it's really just like crypto stuff, just like it's really just a smaller group of people being really, really vocal and annoying about this. And
yeah. I mean, and like, but I mean, I gotta say, man, the idea of, oh, you know, the idea of like the individual artists being overtaken by these technological changes and advances and people who want to use that instead, that's exactly describing what Eddie Trunk and Sebastian Bach were upset about, right? Why are they using computers? There should be people playing these instruments. And that's it is an insult to the artistry and technique and the time spent to learn these skills to do this stuff, to use a computer program to imitate it, right? Like you see similarity there, that. Right?
Yeah, I can see that. And the thing, you know, for me is that it's not, when someone's playing a synth part, yeah, a synth player could have been hired to play that part, but someone did go in and play those parts or program them on a computer, and then it's just replayed.
Somebody
back.
Programmed
just
them like, on a computer, right? That's the key.
Yeah.
Somebody programmed like them on a computer.
I use a drum sampler program. Okay, so someone went into a studio,
stole a job from an actual drummer.
They got paid.
Shaking my damn
to
head.
Sit down. No, here's what I'm saying though. They got paid to sit down, do all the samples, whatever MIDI grooves that I can use that come with that pack. They were paid to make those grooves and have a license for it and all that. That's fine. And then I can go and I can write my own patterns using those samples. And that person was paid to do that. Now, if an artist wants to say, hey, here's my library of art, give me money, and now you can pull from this to make your AI art. Go for it, man. Do it. I'm all for you getting paid if that's what you want to do.
What about an AI art thing that pulled exclusively from like public domain images? Would that be okay?
I think that's fair game. I think that's fair game.
Do
any of them
do that? I don't even know anything. I don't have an agenda here. I'm just curious because it's just
I'm sure there are folks
who log on to, you can't log on to social media these days and be following comics people and not see drama about AIR and opinions
drama
about AIR.
Drama
period. Yeah. But and so hearing you describe it happening in another, describing basically an older model of this argument from a different medium and industry is fascinating to me. I don't have a horse in the race, man. I don't have any interest in doing an AI art book. It would be terrible. It would be awful, right? Because what I was talking about earlier. Because I just want to be clear about this, because I've also seen people being like, oh, you know, if you're a writer and doing stuff with this, you know, people are watching and people are going to know. So please, that's not my goal here. But I do find it interesting, right? I like digging down to see what the source of the upset is. And if the source of the upset is, well, people's work is being taken without their permission and being loaded into a computer program and then used to produce derivative works for which they are not being paid,
That's my main problem with it.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I don't see that articulated as much as I see just the mere existence of this thing is morally abhorrent, which to me sounds very similar to like the Eddie Trunk Sebastian Bach thing thing shouldn't exist because, you know, drum machines shouldn't exist because that's a job that could have gone to a drummer. In the old days, you would have had to hire a studio musician, and those people used to make good livings, and now they can't anymore because they're drum machines, right? Like that's the same argument as a lot of people have for AI art, which is that, oh, if AI art exists, then magazines aren't going to hire artists anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's an argument I've seen quite a bit. And that's very similar to the Eddie Trunk, Sebastian Bach one.
In the terms of comics, I don't see that ever being a thing that will ever, there will be a few blips where people are like, look, an AI comic and blah, blah, blah. And maybe there might be some examples where it doesn't turn out like complete dog shit. I haven't seen any of those examples yet, but
me neither.
But when it comes in terms of like illustrations for magazines or concept art, or I'm going to say it, metal album covers, because a lot of this shit looks like rejected metal album covers to me.
They do, 100%.
You know, when it comes to that, yeah, I can see that happening. You know, again, I do have a personal horse in this race as being an artist, but also, you know, people who are going to use AI art to make comics, more often than not, like I wouldn't want to work on whatever the story they're doing anyway. Like, it's probably That's not right. that great. Because to be honest, a lot of these guys who are really vocal about their prompts and all these things, these are the guys who, you know, live on the smell of their own farts. You know, there's such ego involved with it that they would probably be impossible to work with anyway. And not that artists themselves can't be that way, because they certainly can. But just in this particular case, and like you said, like my main issue is when people's work is being taken without their permission to feed into this machine. And a lot of these guys, they like, oh, here's the prompt, what I did to make this beautiful image. And it's got a fucking artist name right there. And they're like, I never allowed this. Like, why, you know, that's where it becomes morally abhorrent to me. Like, just ridiculous. When it comes to the fact like, oh, we're playing with this and we're doing this, I get it. You know, I really get it. I get it as if I was just a writer and I'm like, I wanted to like express things visually, and there's a way I can do it with my words, and it can pull up things that can bring that up. Yeah, of course I would be interested in that, but I don't want to steal someone else's things. Well, just like,
I mean, another thing that's interesting about the AI art, man, is that I don't see discussed very much is its value. And like, this is how it always goes with this stuff, right? Like, you know, when computer generated animation started being a thing, traditional animators,
yeah.
Yeah, they said all the same stuff. This happens all the time. And then what happens is the technology advances to the point where it can be used as an effective and reliable tool for something. The AI art is not there. It's just, it's a toy at this point. And maybe it'll get to a point sometime soon when it can be utilized in a reliable fashion. And at that point, who knows, man? Maybe, you know, because there are plenty of cartoonists out there, not necessarily in the direct market, but definitely in web comics and other venues like that, who are using a lot of digital tools to create their work, right? Who's to say there's not an opportunity for, you know, LA skyline at night with a blimp in the background, right? You've got it. There you go. Now you can draw your art over top. Now you can draw your expressive, nuanced art over top of that. I don't see that, or even, you know, trace it and add flourishes and do different things to it. It's no different than SketchUp at that point, which more people than anybody listening to this realizes use all the fucking time.
It is. Yeah. It's in that manner. Yeah. As a resource, as a tool.
Yeah, for exactly. sure.
You know, there's tons of what, you know, especially the more, not knocking it just because, but more simplified, where it's, you know, simple characters, simple drawings. I know a lot of them have like, they recycle heads, they do things and do that, but they also, you know, it's the name of the game. That's fine. I don't care. And you know, I do want to make a point of saying that as much as I am for, you know, art being stolen, all that, I would feel the same way if it was for writers. If someone's feeding comic book scripts into a machine, because people have been feeding scripts into AI machines anyway.
Sure.
But if someone were actually say like, we don't need comic book writers anymore. We fed all, you know, 80 plus years of Amazing Spider-Man into this. So now we have new issues. Like, I would say that's bullshit.
Is anybody who's not just some like rando crank on the internet saying that we don't need comic book artists anymore? Is anybody actually maintaining that?
I would come up with nothing if I saw something like that. It's mainly, I think it's mainly a few, just because the people who are so vocal about it are just people who are just kind of insufferable to begin with, you know? Yeah. And I'm, you know, and if someone I know is offended by that, you know, it's just what I'm seeing. It is literally just what I'm seeing. And I try to give people the benefit of a doubt. I see some of these, you know, things being shared and dunked on. I'm like, well, let me see what's going on. Like, cause you know, there's parts of me where it's like, well, maybe it's someone who, you know, through some sort of accessibility issue in terms of like, maybe they are, you know, are artistically minded, but maybe they have a disability or something like that, and that you're trying to figure out a way to be creative again. Like, do you give people the benefit of the doubt? Like, do you want to use the tools they can to make the things they want to make? But it's usually it always ends up with like, well, here's the prompts I use, and it's some artist's name in the prompt who you search that artist, and you're like, I never allowed this. So it's just like, all right, there you are, there it is. So, mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I think it can be a great tool. I think it can be a great resource. I think if people want to license their art to feed these machines to generate these images, more power to you. I want you to get paid. That's the thing. Yeah. If someone's going to be using your work, I want you to get paid. Just mm-hmm. like, you know, the drummers who sample the drum beats and the grooves and all that, they get paid for their work. And that's, you know, that's, I think, fair. You know, you're off. That's the work for hire, right? Here's my work. Use it as you want. And I think, you know, in the future, it could be something that's really useful. Like you said, with you know, effects, computer generated effects, CGI and digital animation, people were initially like, oh, traditional animators are out of jobs and stuff like that. But I feel there's like so many more animation companies, or there were so many more animation companies, and all these other people working, and all these, it's not just animators anymore. It's, you know, all these people making all the framework for all these movies. So there's even more work, more jobs being generated and things like that. And
that's not true, by the way.
It's like not, what you're it's saying. Not, okay.
Like, it's a situation where there are more studios because it's cheaper, because they don't have to hire so many animators to do this stuff. So it whenever there are these technological advances, there are costs associated with them, right? Yeah. Like, it's so, like, I don't know, it's, and that's what's tough about this stuff, right? Is like, people have very firm opinions about when it's happening, and then they get used to it, and it's just, it's how it's always been, right? They're Pixar movies, and there's just, you know, there's 8 dozen of them a year, however, I don't fucking know. Like, but like, it's, I don't know. It's interesting to me, man. I don't really have a point here. I just thought it was a very...
We're not solving the crisis here.
It's a funny thing, though, right? Because it's like, and to your point, there is like there's a very clear distinction between using people's art without their permission, and like, being upset about that is one thing. Being upset about the existence of AI art is, I think, another. And one of them is a very valid thing about making sure that people who created something get the credit and money and recognition for it that they deserve. And then the other one is kind of old man screams at clouds. Yeah. If I'm being honest with you. And it's also, and if I may, you know, the other one, this like fear of AI art, like this, like, I've seen like an existential fear and anger at AI art, just like the sheer fact that this stuff exists. And that to me is kind of upsetting, because, you know, do you think, like, to be upset about the existence of that stuff, and to think that it's any kind of imminent or even anytime soon threat to the existence of actual artists, I think that betrays a belittling view of what artists do. Yeah. What an actual artist does, you know, whatever prompt you give an AI thing, it'll produce something, and you might say, oh yeah, well, that does look kind of like Richard Corbin drawing a Catman or like whatever. Right. It's a little insight into my brain that's the first thing that I came up with. But you know, and they could come up with that. But if I said, Don, could you draw me like a Corbin-esque Catman? What you would deliver would be worlds better for a bunch of different reasons. One is you would engage with the assignment and the, as a whole, and you would create something as opposed to just piecing something together and crossing your fingers, right? Two is you would bring yourself to that work. Dawn would also be present in that work. And that is something that a AI program, at least as AI exists right now in the year 2022, cannot do. It cannot, I mentioned it earlier, it does not have nuance. It does not explore metaphor. It does not explore visual themes. It does not know when to break the rules, which is an important part of any kind of artistic creation. It doesn't have any of that stuff. So like, the existential fear of it is kind of bewildering to me sometimes. Mm-hmm.
honestly. No, and like, yeah. certainly there are, as to your point, there are instances where, like, you know, metal covers. Well, listen, let me tell you something. If you're a metal band that is like, you know what, let's just go ahead and do the free AI art. They weren't going to be hiring you for any kind of rate that you wanted to be working for, yeah, anyways.
There is that argument as well. Like,
the people who are going to be losing jobs from this are like the guys on Fiverr, which, mm-hmm. guess what? 5 years ago, people were furious at the guys on Fiverr for
You don't hear people complain about Fiverr anymore.
Exactly. It's, I don't know. It's interesting, man.
Yeah.
We got way off topic. Metal.
No. We're talking about comics. This is a big thing in the comics industry.
It is. It's a big thing right now.
And you know, I completely agree with the fact it's just not there yet.
It's not useful. It's a toy. Things. It's a toy.
I think what happens though, it taps into that vein of the worth of the artist. And that is such a fire starter in the comics industry, is the worth of the creative. Because, you know, I don't know if we've said it live here in the podcast or before we were chatting, but comics, best medium, worst industry. It's just that thing. And I think that's what fuels so much of it, because it, you know, in seeing these examples, like, this storytelling's dog shit. Like, it doesn't work. It doesn't have that nuance, you know?
And there's no construction of the page. It's what I was talking about earlier. Yeah. There's no, like, you can, you can tell an AI, you can feed your script to an AI program and get the five panels for your page, and then you can crop them however you need to and put them together on a page. That's not a comic book page. I know there are more artists than I would like who do create comic book pages like that, but that's not how a good comic book page is created. A good comic book page is created with an eye towards the totality of the page, as well as the way that the totality of the page interacts with the totality of the pages around it. All of this stuff is a holistic concern that AI cannot do. It's a non-starter.
No. I do appreciate you trying, making the connection with the music aspect of it, because, you know, there can be similarities of it. And to clarify a little bit, the whole Eddie Trunk thing, they were also more ragging on the fact that they canceled the show because they didn't have the laptops, and they're like, just go out there and F and play, man. And it's like, well, you know, I can understand like the mentality of like, just go out and play your songs, man. Who cares if you don't have, you know, the symphony track behind or whatever. But like I said, there's also other factors where there's the guitar switching with the effects and things like that, that they probably just don't have that capability without those things there, because that's how they do the show, because bands have to run really lean to make any money. So technology allows them to run really lean. But again, it's a tool is what, and I think AI stuff can be used as a tool. Like you mentioned, like you can use it like SketchUp, you know, which so many people use. You know, I draw digitally. I use plenty of, I made guitar brushes that I can draw. I made the different models of guitars because I'm going to be drawing a lot of guitars in my books. I'm like, I'm just going to make a bunch of them and I can manipulate them, and that'll give me the bass and the scale and everything that I need to just draw over it and then save me so much more time.
We were talking about earlier. It's not a question of what tools you use or what idioms or techniques you use. It's how you take those things and how you execute.
Exactly.
How you use them to create the sum totality of your art.
Exactly. And speaking of using things, we have a couple Twitter questions. First up is from Rusty Shackles.
Friend of the show, Rusty Shackles.
Current enemy of the show. Friend. Rusty's a good bud. Champion of the Pocky Chip Challenge for the show. But he wants to know, what's your secret to your glamorous and luxurious hair? Tell us your routine.
Every 4 or 5 days, I wash it. I use conditioner. And right now I'm using a heavier conditioner than I would like, because it's just left over from when I had much more hair. But every 4 or 5 days, I'll con wash it, and that's it. I don't do anything else for it. I just let it get real dirty, and I rub my hands through it all the time.
There you go, Rusty.
Easy.
May it serve you well.
I'm blessed that I don't have to really do much to it.
And, you know, I think it's long past time to start addressing your work, and our next question does that. From Grim Wilkins, they would like to know, will we see any beef sisters or gender resistors in the next Beef Bros?
So first of all, I got to say, Grim is the beef father. And what that means is Grimm is the guy who put me and Tyrell together. Because he he very accurately spotted the incredible overlap in Tyrell and my interests. Mm-hmm. And one day I think he just said it on main in public for God and everyone else to see. Aubrey and Tyrell, y'all should know each other, work together. And we did not know each other, but we followed each other. Mm-hmm. And then went and looked at each other's and came back and said, hey, Grimm was right.
There you go. Grimm is wise.
Yeah, man. He knows what he's doing. So he said, Grimm is in. Has he been on the show before?
No. Grimm and I have been following each other for a minute, and I definitely want to speak to them for sure.
Are they a they? I thought he was.
I try to default that's to smart. If I don't wise. Know for sure, because you know
that is wise and considerate. However, I do believe that Grimm identifies as a he him, and he is an amazing cartoon. He is utterly brilliant. People need to go pick up his Miranda immediately if they have not. It is a masterclass in silent but also plex storytelling. It's beautiful. It's wonderfully nuanced, dense material, despite which is an odd thing to say for something that is silent and does not have dialogue. But it is, and there's a lot to unpack in it, and a lot of it's based on page layout and design, and it's wonderful. I can't say enough good things about it. To answer his question, though, and I saw this earlier, which I'm glad for because I had a chance to think about it. No, the answer is no. There aren't currently plans to have beef sisters or beef gender resistors, and there's a reason for that. And it's not to say that it'll never happen, but you know, a core component of Beef Bros is, you know, it's upending and repurposing a lot of the tropes and ideas of 80s and 90s macho entertainment, right? So inclusive of like 80s muscle man action movies and beat 'em up and fighting games and fight anime and 90s superhero comics, of course. A lot of that stuff is rooted very much in this nasty, and it's, you know, I feel like it was very much a buzzword and then got overused to a point, but truthfully, it's rooted in a really nasty, toxic masculinity. It's rooted in this idea of manhood and masculinity that is destructive, mean-spirited, and domineering, and not just patriarchal, but rigidly hierarchical. And a big part of the idea of Beef Bros is being a loving, community-based, non-hierarchical version of masculinity, right? And so that's not to say that they're like, I mean, you know, if we were a, if we were like a comic series running 100 issues, well, of course, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. You explore all options.
Of course, we would explore all options, right? But we've only done two of these things, man. And I think that there's a lot more that needs to be done and explored specifically with, you know, and this, if people have read Beef Bros, they know. But if they don't, you know, a core part of Beef Bros is the main characters, Huey and Ajax Beef, love each other. Mm-hmm. Dearly, not in a way that is ironic, not in a way that is gay panic, not even in a way that is queer coded. And I think that that is significant and important. It is a deep agape love for one another. It is beyond platonic. It's beyond philos, like brotherly love. It is a deep love for one another and humanity that informs all of their actions. And being able to depict that as not juxtaposed with, but rather central to masculinity is, I think, it's important. It's important. And to me, it's a big part of what Beef Bros is. So I'm not saying no, there would never be a beef sister or a beef gender, you know, a beef sibling, right? Like, yeah. I'm not, I'm not saying that that would never happen, but it's not particularly a priority for me because it's not really what Beef Bros, you know, Beef Bros is about kind of reclaiming and reclaiming a positive masculinity, which, you know, in all the discussion, which there's been a lot of toxic masculinity, I think there's been a dearth of discussion of, well, what do we have to replace that? What do we replace? What does it look like? You know, like we know all the ways that men are toxic and the way that toxic masculinity hurts everyone, inclusive of men, right? And boys, right? Mm-hmm. But what is the good version of this look like? And that's what Beef Bros is.
Yeah, that well said. It makes total sense. Like you said, you're not done exploring the Beef Bros yet. So, you know, but you know, hopefully, I don't know, whatever the future holds.
Hopefully we'll do a million of these, man. Yeah.
You know, Beef Bros a year for the next 40 years. Who knows?
I'm doing the math in my head about how old I'd be.
I'm trying to imagine 40 years from now, Aubrey swinging that thing in the Kickstarter video.
Mace. Very slowly.
It'd just be like a cane with a tennis ball at the end at this point. But for sure. I don't want to keep you too long. I'm happy to keep chatting if you want to keep chatting. But
I can keep chatting. Hey, can we pause? Can I pause and we can go to the? I can go to the bathroom.
Go for it.
Hell yeah! That's not going to screw up your editing. You can leave this in. No. You can just do a song and dance while I'm peeing. It's number one. Yeah. It won't be very long. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'm going to do something so I don't have to edit. Let's do this. All right, Comics Coffee Metal listeners, Aubrey's off to relieve himself. We've been talking for quite a bit. I asked Aubrey if he's cool with keep chatting because, you know, before we started recording, he was kind of happy with the fact that I was trying to keep my episodes a little bit shorter. But, you know, we got on a couple topics that we were both a little more than willing to expound upon. So that's why I went and asked him if he could stay a little bit later. I'm hoping you're enjoying this chat and all that. We're going to talk about, you know, Beef Bros. We're going to talk about No One Left to Fight and a bunch of other of Aubrey's awesome works. And yeah, I hope you've been enjoying this. I'm finding out right now, I'm not really good at just vamping here while someone else is doing something. So cause I feel like I want to ask a question and no one's going to answer. No one's going to answer this question. So this is going to be an interesting segment of the podcast. So, but what's more exciting, I think, is the fact that by the time this airs, you'll have seen that I've been clipping out video segments and putting them on my YouTube channel of these podcasts. I'll have some from Dalton DeShane up before this up, and I'll have some from this podcast up. So you'll hopefully get to see our reactions to each other as we're saying ridiculous things since we're doing some video, and some clips will be up. And Aubrey's back, so I can be done poorly vamping.
Were you saying awful things about me?
No, I just spent the time talking about how I don't know how to spend the time talking about. So
okay, that's pretty meta. I like that. No, I apologize. I had this big glass full of gin that I drank while we were chatting, I just had to take care of some things. I apologize.
I won't keep you too long, but yes,
No, I'm having fun. This is great. This is great, man. Thank you for having me. I'm having a blast.
And I'm
always very cagey when I agree to do podcasts about like how much time I agree to. And then, you know, if I'm having a good time because it goes way fucking over. So no, man, let's chit chat. This is wonderful.
I would be remiss if I don't mention before we continue the fact that, we've had some jesting about Megadeth.
Your favorite. That up in your the absolute metal favorite.
Are you a big Megadeth fan?
I'm not a big Megadeth fan. You know, truthfully, I am not the big. I like some crossover thrash. I like some thrash, but of like the '80s thrash guys, I like Exodus probably the most. Exodus is probably my favorite. Megadeth is a close second, but even then, like there's like. I don't know. There's like three Megadeth albums that I listen to. Like I couldn't claim to be a big fan. I do like them more than Metallica though. And that's your beef with Tyrell, isn't it?
Just yes, it's
yeah. I know, like not like like you guys aren't gonna duel.
Metallica was my band. It was your band. You know, if again, if I had to pick my number one band of all time, just sheer hours listened to and you know time spent, yes, Metallica for sure. Megadeth was I'm 40, so I was like in teens in the late 90s and all that. So there was still the Metallica versus Megadeth thing. So it was either like you liked Metallica or you liked Megadeth and, you know, fuck the other one, you know?
Yeah.
So if I had to make a list of Megadeth songs that I actually enjoy, I could probably make an album's worth of tunes.
Would it be Rust in Peace?
No, actually, you know,
it would just be the entire Rust in Peace.
So, yeah, it's just, hold on a second here. We were talking so long, I don't know if that's going to come through, but, I'm recording myself directly into my program where I have all my templates set up for my show and the end music for the podcast started playing.
Let's wrap it up.
I'm being played off by my own computer. But the,
So there's a lot that's interesting about Megadeth and Metallica, yeah. Right? Like even like the historical stuff, I know the broad strokes. But like what I was actually thinking about this today, cause we were joking about it on Twitter. I think mostly me, I was making jokes about it, cause I had seen you and Tyrell joking about it before, but it's funny, man. Like I'm not anti-Metallica, but I've never been a big Metallica fan. I like some early Metallica albums and, yeah. You know, like the singles you'd hear on the radio. It's like, yeah. Mm-hmm. But like at that point, I feel like it's more familiarity than anything else.
Yeah. Sure.
But, you know, they're very different bands. They're different bands, you know, like Metallica is on their artistic journey, man. And each album's a little different and they're doing something different. They're trying different things and, you know, they've got different eras and they swap mm-hmm. out, you know, they swap out different musicians and things kind of change a little bit. Megadeth is more like just Dave Mustaine's AC/DC, right? It's Dave Mustaine and they do the things that Dave Mustaine does. And it is so reliable. It's like AC/DC. And it's like, no, like AC/DC is not my favorite band, but I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and God and myself and say I don't like AC/DC or Megadeth, man. I love that new album. Yeah. Not like I couldn't tell you anything substantive about that new album, except for the fact mm-hmm. that sounds like fucking Megadeth to me. and that's great. That works for me.
That's a good analogy. They are kind of the very much the thrash AC/DC.
They are.
But it's also, but you know, it's like name an AC/DC album after Back in Black. Like,
you know? Oh yeah, I couldn't.
Yeah. Most people aren't going to be able to do that. My biggest hurdle of entry for Megadeth is Dave's voice. Sometimes works fine. Fair. Like there's songs like, you know, Trust, great song. What was it? Symphony of Destruction. Of course, you know, of course it's a jam. You know, Train of Consequences. That's a good one. It's a little bit different for them, but it's good. I think there's a couple off the new, the one before this one, that were pretty good. And there's a few more, you know, like Hangar 18. You can't deny that song, you know? But for me, yeah, Metallica was always they always did it for me because I think every Metallica song album I've listened to was for some reason, wherever I was in my life at that point, that's the album I needed.
That's cool.
I first got into them with the Load Reload era, and that's kind of where I was, you know, mentally and all that, in that kind of headspace. And then I went back and I really appreciated the thrash stuff and all that. And even when they were thrasher, even when they had Mustaine's writing credits and riffs on there, it still does not sound like Megadeth. Like they're just, like I said, there's different.
No, they're different bands. They're wildly different.
And
bands.
Even when Saint Anger came out, like that was an album that, I'm not going to say it's a great album, but I think it's definitely underrated in terms of like there's stuff there where the barrier entry of the production being absolutely dog shit is like intentionally though. I really feel like it was an intentional choice to make it just sound bad.
I like that Death Magnetic album a lot.
That was a really good return to form. A lot of people were upset with the mixing of it because it's so brick walled in terms of the waveforms. Like you can't, it's just, you,
that's just kind of how rock albums were produced in that era.
That's the loudness era and all that. Like Hardwired is a great album too. You know, it's not their greatest album. It's not in their top three or four albums, but it's still a really good album. There's a ton of
songs.
Do you
like Exodus, or does what's his nuts's voice bug you? I don't know the singer's name.
Same principle. Like there's stuff I like because Gary Holt is just like a riff machine. Yeah,
he's a monster.
Like I cannot deny those riffs. A band that I couldn't really get into before, an older thrash band, but I'm really into now is Testament. They are better now than they were when they were kids. When they're
Testament
like,
riffs,
50, 60 year old men, like, and they are just kicking ass. Yeah. But yeah, so that's kind of where I lie on it. Like, you know, maybe, you know, 20 years ago I would have said, yeah, F Mustaine, blah, 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 whatever. Laughed at him crying about, you know, missing his Danish friend in that documentary. Some kind of monster where him and Lars had a little mini heart to heart. He's like, I miss my little Danish buddy.
That's funny. I didn't know that. I haven't seen that movie.
And I get the criticism of Metallica because Lars is the worst. But you know, but also, you know, Kirk Hammett is like one of the coolest people ever. And especially
Trujillo.
For nerds,
because he's a cool huge man. He was he Suicidal Tendencies guy?
Robert Trujillo. Right? Yeah, yeah.
So
I'm sorry, I cut out a little bit. So I
didn't hear you. But he was right. Rob Trujillo was,
and he's actually now their longest running bass player. Because
that's interesting.
When I first started listening to Metallica, Jason Newsted was my guy. That was my point of entry to Metallica.
Yeah,
he's still my guy. You know, I still love his solo album. Yeah, I wish he would return to harder rock metal stuff, but he's doing what he wants to do, and it's fine. But you know, for me, like, yeah, I just, you know, Metallica is just my stuff. My, you know, I don't mind saying it cause it's probably never going to happen, but like my goal, like if I could ever get Kirk Hammett on the podcast, like that would be my ultimate goal.
Cool.
Because he's had a coffee blend released.
Was he in Exodus or Testament? What was he?
He was in Exodus before they recorded their first album.
Gotcha.
You know, and he's a huge horror nerd. I think he's co-written a comic recently, I think. And then obviously metal. So, you know, that's like the dream, like get is him. It'll never happen. But you know, I always think to myself, like, that would be like the one, like, okay, I can stop this nonsense of a podcast after I do that. Like I could wrap it up and say, good job. Him or Zach Wilde, just because.
Are you excited about the new Pantera?
I'm a bit torn. Because
I'm not a big Zach. I don't have anything against Zach Wilde, but I don't have any real connection or like, God bless him.
Yeah.
Right. He's living his life and doing his thing, but I don't like, he doesn't really mean much to me. And like without Dimebag and Vinnie Paul,
it's not Pantera.
Like,
it's not. Pantera
it's not.
Was Dime and Vinnie and, you know, Phil.
I would rather Phil go back out on the road with Down. That's what I would rather. Yeah.
I think my problem is they're billing it as Pantera and not like, you know,
Phil Anselmo's Pantera
not like a Pantera celebration or something like that, you know, or just because it's like going out with, it's like David Lee Roth and Michael Anthony saying, let's go get a drummer and a guitar player and let's go do this, which they kind of entertained, you know. It's like, it just doesn't sit right. And also, you know, Phil's still kind of questionable in terms of things he's done and
yeah, I don't know. So are all those guys we've mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, don't dig too deeply into your, what's his name? The Metallica lead singer, his politics.
Has some dreadful, views on things. I would be surprised if he was a Trumper, to be honest, but I would not be surprised if I probably know for a fact he has a lot of right-leaning views.
Because, I'm never surprised that anyone who achieves massive success in their chosen field as like teenagers or early 20s, I'm never surprised when they have awful views, because why wouldn't they? Everything worked out for them. They believe in the meritocracy. Well, I'm rich and famous and great because I'm great.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that guy have awful views?
Yeah. You know, I take the Hetfield thing with, you know, like, what do they do versus, you know, what people can assume about them. And they do a lot of work for charity. He does a lot of speaking about mental health. He's definitely had a effed up life in terms of mental health and things like that and seeking treatment and all that. So, you know, and also, you know, Kirk and Lars were both very vocal in their anti-Trump right wing type views. Those guys seem very left. So I would be shocked if he was that hardcore, but I know he's got some, and I'm sure in the past he's probably fallen prey to that whole, you know, it's all part, you know, we all, you know, not that I really made a habit of it, but like when we're all younger, we use the F word or used gay as a, like a negative, you know, pejorative term for things and stuff like that. And then you grow up and you're like, oh, that's really shitty to do. Like, that's not cool. And then you stop doing it, you know? So I can't judge people who, you know, have done that, because you get caught up in like, that was the times, but then you can change with the times too, you know? But, yeah, I don't want to know his politics, and I'm glad he's like, I don't participate in it. But, you know, I am also bolstered by the fact that other people in the band are more along the lines of where I am at with everything. But getting back to the meat of it, the Pantera thing, you know, in the past 10 years doing like a Nazi salute at a concert, it's kind of like not the best look there, Phil. Granted, you are fighting lots of personal demons and addiction issues and things like that, and you may make the best decisions, and you have your own groups of people you hang out with and all that. But just in the general sense of it, like, I'm not super excited about it being called Pantera and them going on to it. I love Charlie Benante's drumming; he's phenomenal. He actually, last time Black Label and Down were in Chicago, like in 2014 or 2015, we went to go see him, mainly for Black Label. And Charlie came out and played on a Down song, and you would swear the drummer switched out with a fucking cannon. Like, it was just intense how hard that man hits those drums. And for, in terms of guitar playing, you know, no one, if you're going to do it, yeah, you pick Zach. Like, he's going to play it as close as possible as Dime did. He'll probably use the long rumored Dime branded guitars, now that his signature guitars of the company he was using like lost the license, or they like separated from the estate or whatever. There's a whole bunch of drama with that. But yeah, in a sense though, I do like Zakk Wylde's work. In the early 2000s, he had an album called 1919 Eternal, which I think was a fantastic metal album. And then he had like four or five albums like every year after that, like one every year. And I felt like he could have not done that and maybe made those into like maybe two or three really good albums, because there seemed like there's a lot of like filler stuff in there. Mm-hmm. But I understand at that point, that's the name of the game. Album tour, record. Like, yeah, that's what you do. So there's my long-winded answer. Yeah, I like Zakk Wylde. He's cool. and, you know, he seems, you know, I would love to have him on the show just because, one, he has the coffee thing, and there are comic associations because, you know, I know Greg Capullo and him are kind of friends and all that. And that was my end to get to, you know, a slightly acquaintance Greg Capullo online, because he was talking about Zakk Wylde, and I'm like, hey, I know about Zakk Wylde. So, you know, I can appreciate, you know, the fact that, I can have some minor means of contact with one of my favorite artists of all time because of that connection.
That's cool.
But yeah, it is what it is. So we've derailed again from talking from your work, and I apologize for that. But you sent me a bunch of PDFs, and I tried my best to get to them as much as possible. Obviously, I read Beef Bros because, you know, I had first one, and I'm pretty sure I had the second one, but I was too lazy to look. So you sent me the PDF already anyway. So check that out. Again, Tyrell's art and the story, it's just really fun. Really, I really appreciate the message and everything that's going with that. No one left to fight. I finished the first volume of it. I got through, and that seems like negative. No, I finished the first volume, and I was like,
I suffered through as much as your work as I could stomach.
I choked down the first volume here, and The first thing that happened when I finished that was like, okay, I need to start the second one as soon as possible. So I'll probably be starting that tomorrow. And then the next thing was like, how is Fico not like a household name at this point?
He's incredible, huh? Yeah. He's doing stuff at DC now.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a quick search, and I'm like, okay. It's being recognized. The work is being recognized, and it's getting higher profiles in terms of like the industry.
I think No One Left to Fight work is better though. You know, and it's, you know, it's something, you know, we've kind of danced around it before too, but you know, there is, when you do creator owned work, it's something different, you know? Yeah. And like for a lot of reasons. And one of them is you are free to do exactly what you want to do. And, you know, No One Left to Fight is a thing that Fico and I designed together from the ground up. And it was very much led by, you know, we had an idea for the type of story we wanted to tell. And then before I could even get going on like a plot or anything, Fico started cranking out character designs, right?
He started with great character designs.
They're amazing, like, right? And they drove the story in a really real way, right? Because he would draw Winda, right? And I'll be like, oh, dang, look at her. And like, I started having ideas about, and he would come to me with ideas and be like, oh yeah, well, you know, Vale has this thing on his belt. And I was thinking like, that's what that could be. And like, this could be a reference to that. And, you know, it was a really important, doing No One Left to Fight was a really important step for me creatively for a bunch of reasons. But one of them definitely was realizing the strength of creating something with the art simultaneously, right? And mm-hmm. because the way most of comics is set up is this assembly line format, right? The writer comes up with an idea, they hash it out with the editor, they decide who's going to draw it, they get brought on board, you know, and that to me is backwards. That's not the way to make good, meaningful comics. I think that you can end up with good, meaningful comics that way. It's not a reliable formula. And the reason is that, quite simply, you know, like, and I experienced this firsthand with No One Left to Fight, there are things about that story, that universe, those characters that I would not have come up with, that would not exist in the story if I hadn't seen Fico's art for it beforehand.
That's awesome.
And I think it shows, man. I think that's why that's one of the reasons it feels like such a fully realized world, because it is, because we came up with all of this stuff together and at the same time, as opposed to me showing up with like a 10 issue outline and being like, here's how it's going to go, figure out how these characters are going to look.
Yeah.
But no, he's incredible. And like, you know, with No One Left to Fight also, you know, cause he, you know, the color, if you looked at the colorist credits, they're strange and they vary like kind of like series to series up, because like sometimes it's like Fico and sometimes it's like Fico with Rossiel and like, yeah, sometimes it's like Fico and Rossiel. They figure that out on their end. I'm not really, I can't really speak to it, but like the point is that like that Fico is very involved in the coloring of those things, and he does all of his work digitally. And in doing so, he does a lot of, you know, when you do your work digitally, you start like the lines start to blur in terms of these disciplines, right? Because like even on pages Fico doesn't color, you look at those like the explosive like energy blasts and stuff like that in No One Left to Fight, those existed in the inks, and there aren't inks because he does it all digitally anyways, but like at what we would call the inking stage in comics.
Yeah, just call it. Yeah, just keep
he's already up. He's already colored that stuff and dropped it in these special effects that then he sends it to Rossiel, and Rossiel does things. So yeah, man, it's like a really there's a synergy there that's possible when you have people with an artistic vision and they're given the freedom to achieve it. And that's what No One Left to Fight is, man. So no, I'm thrilled that your takeaway was I got to read the next one, because that's how it's designed. You know, each of those issues too, it's designed to work like the way I think monthly comics should work, which is serialized soap opera that, you know, delivers exciting visuals and delivers, you know, hefty emotional beat, but also most importantly gets you excited for the next one.
Yeah,
that's crucial. It's how it's supposed to work.
I'm not sure where I'm recalling this metaphor from, but it's bringing to mind something about comics. You know, people like compare comics to movies and things like that. It's like comics can, you know, yes, they can take like the bombast or like, you know, whatever, the intense action and like anything possible from like movies these days. You can go anywhere, do anything or whatever. But in terms of the characters and the emotion of that, you need to treat it like a play. You need to treat it for the people that people need in the back row need to know what the hell's going on. And you need to up it like that. You need to like, cause you mentioned the soap opera aspect of it. And I'm like, that's what brought that to my mind. I was like, you know, someone looking angry, you know, and it would work for some stories, but for stories like No One Left to Fight or you know, a big action story, someone being angry, just being like, like that doesn't work. They need to be, and in their mouth agape and like, you know, the brows, you know, their brows are, you know, practically what unibrow, they're so knitted together and like, just can feel the veins pulsing. Like that's what needs to happen because you can do it and it looks cool and, and it sells the moment.
And I'll tell you something, man, for a long time, I was describing No One Left to Fight specifically and some of my other work too as but No One Left to Fight generally as melodrama. It's Dragon Ball, it's, you know, it's shonen fight comic melodrama, that's what it is. And then I realized later that that's a term that people use mostly pejoratively, like that's not a nice thing to be saying about your work. But it's what it is, man. Like and I've realized that that's something about myself, that I love melodrama, you know, whether it's in pro wrestling or like really soapy super like Claremont X-Men type superhero type stuff. I like fucking Downton. I watched the most recent Downton Abbey movie recently. I love Jane Austen movies. I like melodrama, man. I like if I'm partaking of a visual medium, right? Whether it's a movie, a television show, or a comic, I need. Like, and I never really thought about it because I'm not so much a theater guy. So I never really thought about it in those terms. But yeah, I want to see it from the back. I want to see those raw emotions. I want everything. Like, I don't want measures. I want these characters to be experiencing. Oh, dude. Over the pandemic, I read Wuthering Heights for the first time. It's the same thing. It's melodrama, man. It's like soap opera melodrama revenge story romance. And it's perfect. And I've got a real deep love for that. And it's been in the past couple of years that I've realized that, like, oh no, like, cause I used to think it was fight based storytelling. I liked fight comics. I like wrestling. I like superhero comics. That's like the thing. And I realized, no, it's broader than that. It's melodrama. Like they don't have to fight. They could just have like a very like tense drawing room confrontation at the end of the Gilded Age or whatever, you know? Which I also love.
How many people who are fans of X-Men comics talk about like the episode where they play baseball or the Thanksgiving issue? Like that's part of it. And you mentioned like, you know, melodrama is typically used as a pejorative term, and it's like, but no, it makes perfect sense, because at least in the circles and in the feed and social media I've curated for myself, you mentioned Jane Austen, wrestling, Downton Abbey, just the big drama and stuff like that. Like, that's what I see everybody saying they absolutely love, you know. I did see the latest Downton Abbey movie. I did not watch the series. Good. I've seen both movies because my wife is a fan of the series, so she wanted me. So I'm like, do I need to watch the series and all that? It's not against the series, I just haven't watched it. She's like oh, not really. And kind of feel like I probably needed to, because there's a lot of like, so who's that again? Like, that's, I thought he was dead.
I can't imagine watching either of those movies without having seen the series, because they are mostly, especially the first one, it's just fan service. It's just checking in with this weirdo and seeing what they're up to.
I have to say, just as someone who's seen the two movies, the second one was not good.
I liked it better. It was so much better. That's so interesting.
Spoiler alerts, surprisingly, for Downton Abbey, A New Era. It wasn't.
I don't remember what it was called.
I think mainly that the handling of the matriarch's death, that whole storyline. I forget her name now.
The Dowager Countess.
Yeah.
Duchess, like, just Dowager. The whole,
like, oh, I'm old now, and then everyone's there like, okay, I'm gonna die now, and then it's like, die. It's
like that whole... was bizarre too. I thought that was so strange. I didn't mind it though. I was like, man, I don't know anything about England. I don't know anything about British aristocracy estates. Maybe that's like, normal. I don't fucking know.
This is the thing that got me. It's like, instantly in this movie, everyone's talking about how, like, you're dying. She's like, yeah, I'm dying.
I thought that it's was like, wild too.
What's going on here?
I wrote that off as a cultural difference. And who am I to say? Who am I to judge? I don't know.
But I will say, I have a really bad habit of falling asleep on our Saturday movie night when it's not like, you know, just in general. Like, we still haven't finished Uncharted because I just fell asleep halfway through it. And anyway, but I was awake for those movies.
Oh yeah,
I stayed awake for
that riveting drama.
Yeah, it's, again, but like a big action movie like Uncharted, I'm like, I'm fucking asleep after the first half hour. And my wife's like, do you want to watch it again? I'm like, I'm going to fall asleep again. You got like Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg both doing like, you know, this is how I act. This is the voice I use for every emotion. And it's both Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg doing that cadence and that voice. And it's like, I got nothing here, man. I'm not a huge fan of the Uncharted video game or anything. So I'm not like anti it because of that. It's just like, yeah, it's just anyway. But Downton Abbey's I was up for. I stayed awake for that shit. So
Downton Abbey.
as weird as it was. But you mentioned also wrestling, which I think is probably a better metaphor than a theater play aspect. It's like wrestling is how wrestlers sell things, you know, the kayfabe of that and all that, if I'm using that term correctly, is exactly what I think, you know, comics, if you're going to do the big action comics and the melodrama, that's what you got to look at. Like that's where you should draw at least some inspiration from. And you definitely have done some wrestling comics.
That's the wrestling comics, man. I've done one wrestling comic, but it's a big one.
Are there more wrestling comics in ya, you think?
In
or
me?
Is it just kind of
no I did the wrestling comic. It's kind of how I see it. I was like, is that arrogant to say? I did the wrestling comic that people do in wrestling comics read for research. I hear people tell me that, and people say in interviews, they tell me all the time. I've done my wrestling comic. I used to really, really want to do like a fiction wrestling comic. And I think that it's a tough nut to crack for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I think the two primary ones, one is difficult, but navigable. And the other one, I think, is not navigable. The first one that you can handle is the fact that one of the core components of professional wrestling and what makes it interesting to—I can't speak for other people—to me is the beauty of motion, the beauty of the human form in motion doing these things. You may have noticed there's no motion in comics.
Yeah.
it's not an option. And you know, like the example I always used to give to people is, you know, imagine a power bomb. You know what a power bomb is?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you said earlier, are you a wrestling fan? Earlier you said kayfabe and then no, you like hedged. So I didn't know.
Enough of my friends are wrestling fanatics that I feel like I know way more about wrestling than I would ever know. Like just not being on Twitter. Like I know AEW. I know the name Tony Khan, and I know these things. I'm like I don't watch any of this, but I know people absolutely love certain people, and you know, like, you know,
gotcha. Imagine a power bomb. A power bomb to take place in wrestling. It's instantaneous, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's so quick, and it's really neat, cool thing to watch. To depict a power bomb in comic, just bare minimum, you need three panels. You need them, right? You need the head between the knees. You need the lifting up and like up to the shoulders. It'd be better if you could have four, right? Like, because one lifting up and then another one on the shoulders. And then you need at least one for the impact. Although it'd be better if you had five so that you could have them moving through the air. All of a sudden, if you want to have room for any of these panels to mean anything, you're looking at two pages. If you're doing a 20-page comic script, that's 10% of your issue, one power bomb, right? And now there are, and I think this holds true for kung fu comics, like martial arts type comics as well. And I've done a kung fu comic, and so obviously I believe that this is navigable, right? I think you can handle this through clever writing and conscientious writing and page design. You can do this, right? The thing that I don't think is really navigable for delivering what I like about wrestling, what I think is significant and interesting about wrestling, is that so much of wrestling is people, you mentioned the theater comparison earlier, and people love using that for wrestling. Oh, you know, wrestling, it's modern theater and it's breaking the fourth wall and it's audience interaction theater and it's Brechtian, right? Or people say, you know, oh, it's, you know, wrestling isn't, it's not this trashy art form. It's like The Wire or Game of Thrones or whatever, you know, whatever your favorite hour long thing is. Yeah. And it makes me want to tear my hair out. It makes me want to scream because no, I disagree. And this is like one of like the central theses of that, that comic story, professional wrestling that Chris Moreno and I did, which is that wrestling isn't any of those things. Wrestling is most similar to a magic, or really, if you look at, if you drill down and you see what a magic trick really is, it's a grift, right? Everything about it is a hyper exploitative, mean-spirited, brutal grift from the promoter on down. And it's all based on tricking you, the audience, and getting invested in something that you know is not real, right? In behaving and behaving as if this thing is real and reacting to it as if it's real, despite the fact that you know it is not. And in order for that to happen, you know, there's this old saying, you can't con an honest John, right? And what that means is, in order to get over on somebody, they need to think they're getting over on you, which means they need to think they understand what's really going on. But then the con artist or the wrestling promotion as a whole uses that perceived intelligence that is not legitimate, then better work or grift or the audience again. And that kind of Russian nesting doll aspect of cons and grifts and lies and exploitation is crucial to what I think makes wrestling great. And that's not a thing that I think can be super well represented in any form but professional wrestling. I think that you can do comics that illustrate aspects of professional wrestling, right? And there's a ton of those that do it really well. You mentioned Daniel Warren Johnson's Do a Powerbomb earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but I think what I like about wrestling is, I don't know, it's not something that I would even want to, at this point, it's not something I would even really want to attempt. And part of it's just because I'm like, man, I... That book is long and it was a ton of research and I spent many, many, many hours working on that thing.
You said what you had to say on the subject.
I got it out of my system, man. I still love it, you know? But like, that's one of the cool things about wrestling too, is you can just, you can stop and then you can pick it up again. Cause guess what? They keep making more of it. It's like, it's what I was talking about next week. You know, it's not, wrestling isn't something that you need to be. You can, and I have spent a lot of my life paying just outrageous close attention to it, but it doesn't have to be. It's something you can pick up and hop into. And because it really is, like, when done very well and when it's at its best, what wrestling is about more than anything else is like what we were talking about with that kind of churning soap opera. It's getting you to watch the next one. Right. And I think a lot of people, when they talk about wrestling, they get tripped up on that because they want to analyze it like it's like an episode of, I don't know, whatever a popular show is right now. Right. Like, it's they want to say, OK, well, you know, was this episode good and was there good character development and was this match good? And what did you think about this promo? And just like give it like a scorecard. And a smart, well done wrestling promotion doesn't operate like that. A smart, well done wrestling promotion is concerned about one thing, getting you to watch next week. And then buy the pay-per-view after that. That's all it is, right? And there's something, I think there's something really, it's very crass and ugly. But I think there's something fascinating and compelling about it because it's kind of, to me, it's a mask-off version of everything else, of all other entertainment, of everything. It is just, it's by virtue of being confusing and willfully misleading. And the fact that it lies to you and is open about it, and fans not only are okay with it, but they like it and they encourage it and they cheer this like willful deception, that makes it more honest than other art forms in a lot of ways. And that's something that I don't think can be properly expressed in comics.
No, I totally get it. To be able to relate to that, I'm working on a comic where, you know, the main character's in a band, there's music being played and all that. And while I'm like, yeah, there's definitely ways to do all this, it's tricky, right? Because you have to do it. You can't do it, at least in the way I'm approaching it, exactly the way it's got to be more of a stylized version of it happening. And even then, the music thing is not the main focus. It's just the thing the character does. As for wrestling, it's like it's in a whole encased world. You know, everything's serving the thing. And like you made an excellent point about, you know, the real estate of a comic book to pull off the moves and things like that. And while I'm sure a Daniel Warren Johnson or a Tyrell or a Fico would make that power bomb look just chef's kiss, perfect, and be thrilling and exciting, that's still 10% of your comic. You know, that's exactly. Still that point. So no, I totally get it. And like you said, I want
to make another distinction, because I want to make sure that it doesn't seem that I'm like ragging on all the wrestling comics, right? Because
I didn't get that impression though. That
good, you're doing because that. It's certainly not the intent, right? Because and there's a lot right now. There's a ton of them, right? It's really a question of me thinking about what I like about wrestling and what I would want to recreate about wrestling, right? Because if it comes down to just wanting to depict wrestlers and use wrestlers as characters or use a wrestling promotion as a setting, I feel like I've ticked that box off already, because I did this big nonfiction tome of wrestling stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that box is ticked off. For me, it would be a question of wanting to recreate the feeling that wrestling gives me, right? Like to get that same hit, right? That watching a really great wrestling match gets me. In order to do that in comics, I'd need like 250 pages for one match, right? like I would, like in order to do that, and that's why I say it's navigable, right? Like I could do a bomb ass wrestling. Oh dude, here's the thing. I tried to do something similar when I did Street Fighter G.I. Joe, which is just like this tournament. Right. And it's nothing but fights. Right. And it was kind of like more than a story. It was really just like me just being like, look, this works. This is something that's conceivable. And it's like a proof of concept just for me personally. But the other thing, you know, like wanting to actually, not just use wrestling as a setting or wrestling as an aesthetic or wrestling as a this isn't meant to be dismissive. I just can't remember the name. There's like one recently that it's like Wrestling Macbeth, I think, or Wrestling King Lear. It's a Shakespeare thing. I think it's from Aftershock, or maybe I'm conflating them. There's a lot of wrestling companies right
now. There are.
But like, there's nothing wrong with that. But like that, doing a Shakespearean thing set within a wrestling promotion is a very interesting, cool idea, but that is not wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like that doesn't, that's not the hit that's going to provide you is not the hit that professional wrestling gives. The same way that, you know, if you're doing a comic about a metal band, you know, you can utilize a lot of what you know and love about bands and live music and performance and stuff like that to inform the creation of this comic, but it's not going to hit the same way that seeing a live band would. It's just impossible for a bunch of hopefully obvious reasons. Right. No, and that's kind of how I feel about wrestling comics.
No, I totally understand the thought of like, basically, you know, for you, if you're going to do it, you want to do something that recreates that feeling you have.
Exactly.
And that is such a deep, dark, not dark, a deep, you know, heavy thing to like try to portray for anything at all. I'm currently working on a script about a kind of like a slasher type movie thing. and I'm really, you know, invested in the story, but I want it to give me the same feeling that I had when I was a kid in the 80s and watching, you know, late night HBO when I shouldn't be, and seeing one of those movies. You know,
oh, yeah.
I'm trying to like get that feeling out, and it's a very, very slippery thing to try to grab a hold on to.
But I think that's a noble pursuit, though, right? Is to think about these things experientially and to think about, you know, these powerful feelings that you have experienced and figuring about. And honestly, I mentioned earlier about like why No One Left to Fight was like a big step forward for me, and really embracing that melodrama and being brave enough to say, no, you know, like think about these times that I have felt just shingly sad. Because like people in No One Left to Fight, despite the fact that like No One Left to Fight is drawn and colored like a Lisa Frank comic, like folder, it's sad. Everybody's sad. It's very much like, it's depressive and it's rough, and they're all going through it. And you know, my thinking on a lot of that stuff was very much, what are some of these
deep,
powerful emotions that I felt, right? Not like what are things that I've been sad about, right? Because that's too specific. It's too specific to be powerful, right? What is the core of what was the real reason I was sad? Like what was the actual thing that was upsetting me? What is like the foundational existential thing that was grating on me? And each person in No One Left to Fight has one of them. And I've got enough to go around. But they each got one, and they each got one, and they didn't get like, you know, it's not like, oh, it's like Aubrey has, you know, lived. Aubrey has always struggled to be the greatest fighter in the world, but he's only ever the second greatest, right? Like that hasn't happened if you're not really fully aware of my background. But, you know, the idea of struggling and wanting to measure up and feeling like you're unable to, and feeling like you're maligned against and are prevented from it for whatever reason, that is something that everybody feels. That's a universal thing. And so like I don't know. I think that's where great art comes from, man, is thinking experientially and figuring out ways to, again, it's like wrestling. It's a way of tricking people into feeling these emotions that you want them to feel, and to feel them as powerfully as you can make them, despite or maybe even because of the fact that they know it's not real.
You know what? I hate to say it because I'm having an absolute blast talking to you.
It's late. We've been talking forever, man.
It's late, but I also think this is a pretty, pretty good spot to end the show
pretty good,
on,
right?
Because that's some fantastic advice for anyone creating anything. To use experience and all that. You said it much better. I'm not going to repeat it, but
you can rewind it if you want to hear it again.
Yeah, just rewind it. I'll clip it, repeat it a few times at the end. It's fine. But yeah, we're running past 2 hours here. It's almost midnight by me. I don't know. I forget which coast you're on. So
it doesn't matter.
It's
late either
super
way.
Super duper late for you, or it's still or just a little bit late. But yeah, Aubrey, I had an absolute blast talking to you.
This was awesome. Thank you for having me.
We'll definitely have to do this again.
I'd love
for
to.
For sure. We'll change it up. Maybe we'll do the shuffle interview, and I can ask you some like random ass questions.
Cool.
And we'll get a little crazy with it. But yeah, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Absolute blast. If they don't already know, please let everybody know now where they can find you on social media.
I'm easy, man. You just search for Aubrey Sitterson. There's only one of me. It's really easy to Google. AubreySitterson. I'm most active on Twitter, but that's not saying a whole lot. The best move is to go to veryradcomics.com and subscribe to my newsletter. It's only once a month, so it's not going to clog your inbox. It is updates on comics I've got coming out, which I've got some new ones. They haven't been announced yet, so... Don, I'll tell you about it off the air. But subscribe to my newsletter. You'll hear that. Essays, con appearances. I'm going to be in Twin Cities Con in November 11th and 13th, I believe. I don't know. Look it up. Twin Cities Con. Come see me. Give me a fist bump. And also, I do I do like capsule reviews of everything I've been reading and watching and listening to and actually enjoying in my newsletter. So it's all a fun thing to subscribe to each month.
Awesome. And I'll make sure there's links to all that in the show notes below. So you can just go on your pod player, click a linky, and it'll take you right to where you want to go.
Hell yeah.
Once again, Aubrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. Please be sure to return next episode with my guest, Matt Lisniewski. See you then.